Returning to questioning Paul, the most revealing and incriminating of all the insights that we have garnered so far is the realization that Paul's message, as it's found in his first letter, that to the Galatians, is the antithesis of everyone else's. It's the antithesis of Yahweh's and his Torah prophets and so on, and Yahweh just happens to be God. His message is the antithesis, the opposite of Yahweh's prophets, the opposite of what Yahusha said, who just happens to be the living manifestation of the Word of God. Paul's approach in Galatians is the opposite of what Yahusha's disciples revealed. It was indeed, and it has become, one man against the Word and against the world. Everything the Messiah did and said affirmed the importance of the Torah. He was Torah observant. His entire purpose was to fulfill Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, and Shavuah to enable the benefits of the covenant. And yet the primary thrust of Paul's testimony is to belittle and demean the Torah. His claim to a secret revelation from God, for which he has a license to promote, is not only rationally impossible, it's absolutely preposterous. Well, I'm admitting that I'm flogging a dead pig. Since so many seem oblivious to the obvious, if Paul spent time one-on-one with Yahusha, as he claims in Galatians, why didn't he tell us anything about his encounter? We don't have anything, not a word, not an insight, nothing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. We know about every meeting, every meal, every laugh, every line shared between Abraham and Yahweh, even though those meetings took place 4,000 years ago. We know what Yahweh asked and what Abraham said in response. We know where the meetings took place, what the thrust was of each discussion. 4,000 years ago. And yet, Paul is basing his entire credibility on this meeting with Yahusha, and he can't tell us anything about it. Nothing. And yet, billions of people have risked their souls on this man's veracity. Stupid. It's preposterous. Why, unlike everything else God has revealed, wasn't there a single prophecy which could be used to validate the inspiration? You know that in Yahweh's Torah and Devarim, twice, Yahweh says, listen, if you're wondering, if somebody comes around and says, I'm speaking on behalf of God, I'm going to give you a series of tests that you can use to validate whether or not they're speaking on behalf of God or not. Like I, for example, have used those, and I've come to the conclusion that Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon are not inspired by Yahweh. I've used them, and I've come to the conclusion that the book wrongly named Enoch and Maccabees, not inspired by God. Now, I didn't have to use them, but I could have used, actually, I did use them, but I would use them after the fact to prove that Paul's letters were not inspired by God. Paul violates every single aspect of the inspiration. But I didn't need them to know that because of the fact that Paul contradicts himself and contradicts Yahweh and contradicts everything that makes any sense. So it was just obvious that Paul was lying. But nonetheless, God provides us with a series of tests that we can use to determine whether or not someone is speaking for him. And one of those tests is that Yahweh says that he alone can inspire consistently accurate prophecy. And that someone's claiming to speak for him and they do not predict the future, or they predict the future and get it wrong, a single mistake or a single failure to predict is grounds to determine that they are lying. Paul made two prophecies. One was insignificant. It was about a boat ride. He predicted a doom. It didn't occur. But let's just say he was speaking out of fear and really wasn't a prophecy. The only real prophecy then contained in all of Paul's 13 letters is where he was talking about what he called his harpazo, which is a violent snatching away from which the Christians use the term rapture from the Latin. And he said that he would be among those who would be raptured, harpazoed, caught up in the sky. And so he was predicting that it would occur during his lifetime. Oops. He got his lone actual prophecy wrong. So, since he has no other prophecies to demonstrate the validity of his inspiration, and the one that he actually gives, he got wrong, proving that he was not inspired by God, discard it. Throw all 13 letters away. Now, you might say, so why didn't you just throw them away? Why are we going through this? Because 2 billion people today, maybe as many as 3, have been infected with the poison of Paul's pen. Billions of people have been led astray by this man, and so it is important that we question him and prove beyond any doubt that he lied. The fact that he got his lone prophecy wrong is just one evidence. The fact that he contradicts himself is another. The fact that he contradicts Yahweh is another. The fact that he contradicts Yahusha is another. The fact that he is a horrible communicator is another. The fact that what he claims is preposterous is yet another. But if he met with Yahusha, which he clearly didn't, his testimony, like that of Yahshua, Isaiah, like that of Zechariah, like that of Yirmiyah, Jeremiah, like that of Moshe, Moses, like the Psalms of Dode, David, all are just filled with precise prophecies, like Daniel, that have continued to unfold exactly as they were predicted. It is the trademark of everyone Yahweh speaks through. And then over here you have Paul. Not one accurate prediction. And the only prediction he actually makes, he gets wrong. Why is that not enough all by itself? Why, when Paul admitted that he was demon-possessed, as he does in his second letter to the Corinthians, why was that not enough? Why, when Paul admits that he's insane, why was that not enough? Why, in Paul's most important letter, that to the Romans, when he tells people that the Roman government was installed by God, that people should submit to it, it's God's force on earth for good, and the Romans immediately thereafter destroyed the temple, crucified hundreds of thousands of Jews, hauled other Jews away to Rome to be the slave labor force to build the Colosseum, using the wealth confiscated from the temple to fund the building of the Roman Colosseum, which was, without any question, the most repulsive stage for man's inhumanity for man's religious myth, for the worst of politics and religion to be displayed. And all of human endeavor, no place on earth has ever been as repulsive as what took place in the Colosseum. And yet Paul, in his letter to the Romans, tells readers that that government was installed by God for their benefit. Why? Why would you believe him after that? You're not thinking. You don't want to think. It's not comfortable to think. You're not capable of thinking. It's insane. I mean, being a Christian is insane. And there is no Christianity apart from Paul. You can't get a religion of Christianity out of Yahusha. Even if you know his name isn't Jesus Christ, you can't get Christianity out of what he said and did. He was Torah observant. He was Torah affirming. There is no Christianity from his words and deeds. It's only from Paul. And he was so obviously inaccurate. And worse. The Torah, by contrast, is set into the context of history. It details Moshe's meetings with Yahweh. In addition to their interaction with the Egyptians and the children of Israel over the course of time, there are not only thousands upon thousands of witnesses. The Torah is filled with historical and prophetic insights, which serves to verify its validity. Moreover, its primary purpose was to explain the purpose of God. And that means that Yahusha was not only included, but was also explained and predicted in this very same plan. And now we are asked to believe that all of those promises, all of those predictions, that entire plan was for naught. There was no reason for any of the things that God did or said if we are to believe Paul. Paul's God is wholly impotent. That's irrelevant. History or consistency. Most of the Torah consists of Yahweh speaking in first person through Moshe, which is the same format Yahweh used throughout the prophets. So why is Galatians written in Paul's voice? The prophets Zechariah, Yeshayah, Yirmiyah, and Malachi, to name a few, routinely get out of the way and allow Yahweh to speak through them. Their personalities, their styles, their messages, and their reputations are never an issue. The same cannot be said of Paul. There are seven signs all along the seven paths, the same path, all pointed in the same direction, all conveying the same message, all from the same God. And then there is Paul. And his sign is on a distinctly different path. It points in the opposite direction. And it conveys an entirely different message. And yet for every one person choosing to follow the path laid out by the seven in concert with God, hundreds of thousands prefer Paul's way instead. Now, other than misrepresenting the second most important name and title in the universe, the King James and the Latin Vulgate handled the rest of the words in this passage that we are currently analyzing. Appropriately enough, the King James reads, "For I neither received it of man, and neither was I taught it, but by the revelation of Jesus Christ." The Latin Vulgate, "And I did not receive it from man, nor did I learn it, except through the revelation of Iesu Christi." Unable to restrain themselves, the New Living Translation felt compelled to add their own personal embellishments to an otherwise simple statement. "I received my message from no human source, and no one taught me. Instead, I received it by direct revelation from Jesus Christ. And yet, that's not possible. The words that the flashing light gave him while he was on the road to Damascus don't contain this message. And one of the three depictions of what was said actually quotes Dionysus, the Greek god. So he certainly didn't get it there. So then your only other option is that he claims in Galatians that he spent 3 years in Arabia getting his message, but yet the timeline he presents in Galatians and the timeline that Luke presents based upon Paul's travels and testimony in Acts show that that's impossible. That he didn't spend one day in Arabia, much less 3 years there. And even beyond that, there's, as I said before, there's not a single word from anything that was said during those meetings. So it's an absolute lie. Easily demonstrated lie. And yet, no one seems to care. People seem to think that it's appropriate to put your faith in a lie. But that's what God really wants, is me to have strong faith in this lie. Incidentally, and forgetting about the divine placeholders for a moment, just because the Greek reads Iesou Christou does not automatically mean that it's appropriate to order the name and the descriptive title this way in English. In Greek, like Hebrew and Latin, in fact, in many languages, adjectives follow the nouns they are modifying. But in English, the opposite is true. For example, the Hebrew reads Ruach Kodesh, but in English, it's written set apart spirit. But then at issue is whether Messiah is an adjective or a title. And if it is a title, why is the definite article routinely omitted? And also, since Paul has already deployed Satan's title, the Lord, writing the Lord, Iesou Christou, why is the improper title and the proper place, but the proper title is not? So why is the improper title in the proper place, the Lord, which refers to Satan, but the proper title, which is, let's just assume for a moment that Christou is somehow a translation of Messiah, and it's not, in the wrong place after the name. That would be like saying Obama president, or George King, or any of the other just absurd corruptions. Rather than the emperor, Octavian, it would be Octavian Emperor. It's preposterous. And yet the preposterous doesn't seem to faze Christians who are convinced that there was a Jesus Christ. Sorry. Turning from the text to the religious translations of it, regardless as to whether it was deployed as an adjective or a title, why is Iesou Christou the lone exception? The only case where the English translators failed to move the adjectives, adverbs, and titles forward so they could precede the nouns and verbs they were describing. Calling the Messiah, Yahusha, Jesus Christ is like writing James King, where King is inferred to be James's last name instead of his title. And yet, it's hard to miss the possible intent and unavoidable consequence. The Messiah, Yahusha, became Jesus Christ to Christians. You can judge as to whether this was incriminating or affirming. This is Paul's 10th, 11th, and 12th statements in the first chapter of Galatians. For because currently and simultaneously men I persuade, I presently actively and actually use words to win the favor of seducing, misleading, coaxing, and convincing, appeasing and placating, or alternatively, the God. Or by comparison and contrast, I seek and desire to please and accommodate humans. Yet, nevertheless, if men, I was pleasing and accommodating, exciting the emotions of and lifting up a slave of Christu. Certainly, not was me. But nevertheless, I profess, reveal, perceive, provide, and declare to you, brothers, of the beneficial messenger and healing message, which has been communicated advantageously by, under, and through, because of and controlled by myself, because it was not in accord with man. But neither because I, by man, associating myself with it, nor was I taught or instructed as a disciple, but to the contrary, by way of a revelation and appearance, serving to uncover and unveil of Iesu Christu. It's laughable that Christians have been beguiled into thinking that verbal diarrhea is the inerrant word of God. That's a God I would never want to meet. He would be a nincompoop. Paul's animosity towards the Torah began before his conversion. As a rabbinical student, he had been trained to argue against God. So, Paul wasn't so much addressing his former association with Judaism, but instead revealing the mindset which permeated his writings. Initially, at least before I discovered that each of the hundreds of times Torah was written in Yahweh's word as a proper noun, that it was translated using nomos throughout every extant copy of the Septuagint, I was hopeful that by confessing his affinity for Judaism and the religion's oral traditions, Paul would associate his use of nomos with the Talmud instead of the Torah. But that did not happen, and it is not possible. While he knew the Talmud's oral laws like the back of his hand, Paul never made the connection to rabbinic law, and he routinely associated the nomos he was assailing with Yahweh's Torah. Moreover, the notion of rendering nomos as anything other than Torah is torn asunder by Paul's own translation in Galatians 3:10. So now, listen carefully to what he has to say. For because indeed you heard of my behavior in some place and time, in the practice of Judaism, namely that because throughout and accordingly, showing superiority, surpassing any measure of restraint, I was aggressively and intensely pursuing the called out of God. And I was and am devastating her, continuing to annihilate her. Galatians 1:13. Now I'm going to share with you the Nestle Allen's Interlinear. It presents the same revolting palette of words using a slightly more sparse array of colors. It reads, you heard for the my behavior, then in the Judaism, that by excess I was pursuing the assembly of God and was ravaging her. All right. Before we get to the specifics of this, let's begin by realizing that Paul says that he was an advocate of the Jewish religion. We also recognize that in addition to being an advocate of the Jewish religion, that Paul was attacking, annihilating, massacring, by his own admission, those who were called out. Now, Yahweh is known to say, you know, there is a disease, a religious disease in my home, and I want that disease eradicated. But Yahweh is never, ever devoted to saying, what I want is I want somebody to go after my chosen, my children. Now, Paul was going after, they called out the ecclesia. The ecclesia are associated with the mikre. That's who he was going after. He was going after God's children. aggressively and intensely pursuing them, devastating them, annihilating them. The likelihood that such a man was doing so spoke for God is zero. Hello, Kirk. How are you, my friend?
Good morning. I'm pretty good. I'm a little discouraged after the first 2 hours of hearing. I'm not sure anybody will get it if you lay it right there in front of them. And obviously, that's right. What you're doing with Paul. And I was taking little notes, you know, when I was trying to think of other things that just kind of demonstrate to myself how stupid I was when I was a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? Once you start this, you start to think on your own a little bit about all the different things that Paul said that can't be possibly true. One of the things I was thinking about, though, was the apostles. When Judas went off and hanged himself,
they
got together and they decided to replace him. So they had the authority, regardless, in Christianity at least, we're told they had the authority to replace him. They totally reject Paul, so where does that leave Paul?
Yeah.
By your own criteria. Everything by your own criteria condemns him over and over and over again.
Well, you look at Shimon Kephesh's, Peter's, abject dismissal of Paul at the Jerusalem summit. Mm-hmm. They brought Paul in because what he was saying was the antithesis of what they were saying and what God had said. And Shimon Kephesh gets up and said, your claims to have sovereign authority for the Gentiles is absolute rubbish.
Yeah, totally.
And then in this letter to the Galatians, Paul will condemn Shimon Kephesh, he'll condemn Jacob, he'll condemn Yohanan, Yosef's three closest disciples. Paul condemns all three of them. So no, there is no way in the world that the 11 remaining disciples ever considered Paul. They rejected him.
So you have to, basically you're told to follow the preacher as he follows Paul, as he follows Christ, the mythical Christ. I mean,
it's a real mess. Well, look right here in this statement. Paul is saying that as a practitioner of Judaism, that he went after to annihilate and the inference is Christians here, but it's there weren't any Christians at this time. It was those who had recognized that Yosha had walked out of the pages of the Torah, and that he was attacking them, annihilating them. You know, there really isn't a history of Judaism attacking followers of the way. Yeah, there's a period of time later where, I mean, so at this time, Judaism was so dominant in the province of Yehuda that the only battles in Judaism was between whether the more secular Sadducees and scribes were going to hold more power or the more fundamentally religious Pharisees. You know, they battle between each other for supremacy. But one of the things that we learn that they had no right to capital punishment. They could not on their own do anything because they had to abide by Roman laws. Okay. And they could not establish their own laws in terms of killing. And yet Paul says that based on Judaism, he was a killer. Wasn't the case. Historically, that's a false statement. And at this time, there was absolutely no Jewish religious animosity towards those who were followers of the way.
Well, no, because didn't Jacob, he went to the temple regularly.
Of course.
So who's getting who?
Paul's presentation, the Judaism, was the enemy of the Christians, which is what this passage is inferring. And that as a practitioner of Judaism, he was a murderous fiend killing Christians, which is what he said here, is factually untrue. He may have been a murderous fiend. I wouldn't put that past him. But he most certainly wasn't killing on directions from Judaism. Judaism at the time could care less about the followers of the way. They were irrelevant to them. Now, there is a time where the followers of the way in the province of Yehuda became a quasi-meaningful minority. And they were only a quasi-meaningful minority around 100 years after this time. And it was for a very brief period of time. But Rabbi Akiba, who promoted a false Messiah, he was having trouble with the followers of the actual Messiah, you know, signing up for his Bar Kokhba, son of a star. And so he did identify them by cutting off a portion of their index finger. And so did he kill them? No. But he cut off a portion of their index finger so that they would be known and that, so that they could not defend themselves. And so because of the way that weapons were wielded at the time. And that is the only time ever we find really Jews on the war path towards the followers of the way. And that was 100 years later, and it wasn't murder. And at the time, they had absolutely no authority to do such a thing and no religious reason to do it. When Yahweh reached out to Noah, was he out killing his children?
No.
When Yahweh reached out to Abraham, was he out killing his children?
No.
When Yahweh reached out to Moshe, was he out killing his children?
No, sir.
When Yahweh reached out to David, was he out killing his children?
No.
How about when Yahweh reached out to the prophet Yashayah, Isaiah, or Yirmiyah, Jeremiah? Were either of them out killing Yahweh's children?
No, to the contrary. No.
How about Hosea and Malachi, Hosea and Malachi? Were they out killing Yahweh's children when he reached out to them?
No, sir.
When Yosha chose his disciples and went by and found the fishermen, for example, Shimon Kephesh and Yaokanan and Jacob, were they out killing his children?
No, they were fishing, I believe.
Yeah. Does Yahweh have a case study where he says, you know, the guy that I think would be the most attractive, the most useful spokesperson for my message is the guy that's out killing my children?
That is pretty laughable.
It is pretty laughable, isn't it? Paul is saying this as a means of credibility, man. I was a big honking dude in Judaism, man, and I was given the mission to go out and kill the called out. First of all, it's historically untrue. It's religiously untrue. And if it were true, and it's not, it would exclude him for being a witness. So, no matter how you look at it, historically, at this time, there is no history whatsoever. And I want to tell you, the Jews, religious Jews, the scribes, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, man, they could write, and they did, and they have copious records from this time. And did they say that during this time that they had the authority to kill?
No, in fact, they said the other. They remember they have to go to for Yosha.
Right.
They had to go ask somebody to kill him.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. And did they go after the followers of the way immediately after Yosha's death?
No, they may have hid out because they were scared, but they certainly weren't. There was no mass. They moved around rather freely. All the way up, you know, several months afterwards and years after that.
Yeah, Shimon Kephesh, Peter, where did he preach out of?
Out of Jerusalem.
When they confronted Paul for his errant preaching, where did they call him to?
That was in the Jerusalem summit.
Right. So obviously they're not being hunted down in Jerusalem, are they?
No, they're speaking very freely. I mean,
and
they're going to the temple.
Right.
And they're observing Passover and everything each year.
All right. So you put that in contrast with Paul's testimony here, and it's obvious historically, religiously, the eyewitness account, no matter what you look at, including God's own proclivity and who he chooses to use, that Paul is not only lying, he's presenting himself as a mass murderer.
So how do you reconcile with all the disciples, apostles, continuing on to observe Passover, Matzah, so forth, Sukkah, like we are today, and also, you know, for years and years to come, and to go into the temple? How do you reconcile that if everything has changed? Did they forget? They just didn't get the message? Yosha just
forgot to
tell them?
Yosha told them exactly the opposite. He says, don't think I've come to change. Don't think I've come to annul the Torah. Don't think that for a second, because it's not true. You know, so you've got Yosha and his disciples saying exactly the opposite, doing the opposite of what Paul is saying and doing.
Yeah, when he says, you know, don't, if you take serious, don't change a jot or a tittle.
Yes.
And then Paul never quotes anything from Yosha, and Yosha quotes everything from the Torah.
Right.
And it's a totally different message. I mean, at what point do even the stupid minds like me can't figure this out? I mean.
Yeah, you know, and I put myself in that area too. And I had thought that I only had one redeeming intellectual quality, that I'm usually able to use evidence and reason to ascertain those things that are not true. And for some reason, I never applied evidence and reason to Paul. I was, maybe it's like you, Kirk, that we grew up in an environment where we were just told, this is the inerrant word of God, and Paul's letter dominated the Christian New Testament, and we never questioned him. But why, God, when you do, it's so obvious that he lied.
Yeah, it's not even a debate.
No, it's not even a debate. It's the easiest, most obvious conclusion in the world. Paul lied. Thank you, Kirk. We'll be back.
Sir, pleasure.
We'll be back tomorrow.